This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 410A, side one. And it's October the 12th, 1979. Well, there's a lot of news to cover this week on all kinds of events that are taking place that we could update other tapes. I'm going to spend most of this tape on the San Francisco violence, the sniper this last weekend, because it's just a microcosm of what goes on here all the time. And some of you listeners weren't familiar with many of these violences that came down at the time of the SLA or the Manson family. And if I take an event that just took place this weekend and show you what transpired, you can understand the study that I've done into these other bits of terrorism, which I believe are caused by the intelligence community and the police community, and will be very useful later in taking over the country. Before I do that, there just were a few important deaths this past week that I wanted to mention. One was the informant Ronnie Howard, who broke the Manson story. She was in a jail cell with Sue Atkins, who later turned state's evidence on the Manson family, and she was responsible for the original breaking of that story. She was hit on the head and had brain surgery, brain damage, and was in the California hospital, Mount Sinai in Los Angeles, and then died. They had come home, she and her husband, and her husband's brother, he'd come home from a trip to Las Vegas, and she got into a taxi cab, referred to as a gypsy cab driver, I guess outside of the yellow cab line, for whatever name, and her husband went back into the bus terminal, and when he went out, the car was gone, the cab was gone, and she was gone. She was beaten and robbed and left off somewhere, and 3 days later, her husband reported the crime to the Los Angeles police. Her life had been threatened before, and there were firings into her apartment, and she had been harassed by certain persons that had threatened her life, saying that she was a police agent who snitched on the Mansons. The Manson family, and we'll go into that more later on this tape, was very much part of the COINTELPRO program and the police department, FBI, CIA operations, all along from the time that Manson got out of the federal pen. We've talked about that in past tapes with just briefly, and someday maybe I'll do a whole tape on that. I keep promising. There's a lot of things I want to go back and do for you. But the police department in Los Angeles has said there's no connection between her death and her hemorrhaging and in the skull and so forth, with her being the snitch that broke the story about the Mansons. As I say, even though her life was threatened, this is the way the news covers it. Always the police covers it. They don't look for suspects, and they just claim that the $400 she had in cash or $800 in jewelry was the reason that she was beat on the head and finally died from that. A few weeks ago, I was referring to the David Berkowitz case, the son of Sam, and the fact that John Carr, the son of the gentleman that David Berkowitz said in New York was programming him, had died on an army base. He was shot, and the New York Times has a short article this week that the real son of Sam dies in a car crash. Another son of this Yonkers man who owned the dog that David Berkowitz said was programming him died in Manhattan in an automobile crash. He was 27 years old. It was a one-car accident on a highway. This is the second member of the family to die since David Berkowitz, has been imprisoned. He has blamed Sam Carr and his family for programming or giving him the signals to kill. Sam Carr's daughter works at the police department that helped bring in David Berkowitz finally and had a role in catching him, but I believe they knew where he was all along and did have an important part in that case. For those of you who don't have the background, I don't want to fill it in again. You can get the tapes on The Son of Sam and David Berkowitz when I did them last year, a year and a half ago. But the select committee was shot at. He's still living. He's in good condition. If you take your New York Times, September 23rd, 1979, there's exactly two-sentence article, 1 inches, on page 43. Anti-Castro figure is shot, Miami, September 22nd. Antonio Vesciano, a former leader of the anti-Castro Cuban exile underground organization Alpha 66, was wounded in the head. There were shots that came from a car nearby and pulled alongside of his car. He is alive. He didn't die. What the one-inch article didn't say in their two sentences was that Veciano had testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and he spoke about having contact with Lee Harvey Oswald in Miami, and that Oswald worked with the CIA. After Senator Church's committee investigated the CIA in 1976, there were a whole series of murders, including John Rosselli, who had testified, Sheffield Edwards of the CIA, and William Harvey of the CIA, all of the men who had provided weapons for killing Fidel Castro and worked with our domestic assassination teams. So this was an ambush in Miami, but so far it hasn't been successful. Each week we go into the Army biological testings, and a lot of important information that the Church of Scientology is getting through the Freedom of Information Act. They sort of have one time bomb a week. This week it was poison pigeons spread blight, U.S. Army biological warfare tests. Tests were conducted in December of 1950, and infections were put on homing pigeons, and they dropped contaminated turkey feathers in cluster bombs over oat crops in upstate New York and in the Virgin Islands to see if they could get a rust epidemic on cereal in the where the oats were growing, and spread it, use this as a biological warfare weapon. I wonder if there's any people living in these areas, the Virgin Islands or in New York, where the drugs were tested in Watertown, New York, where there would be an upsurge of cancer since the government and the Pentagon decided to drop these. This was under the Army Chemical Corps Biological Department at Fort Derrick, Maryland, of course, and they trained these birds to see if they could drop infections, and they did, in fact, drop infections, and they showed that it could be harmful to crops and get a cereal rust epidemic. So that a chemical warfare by letting birds carry chemicals into the crops, you can starve off people, you can use animals for this kind of testing, and that did prove that it would work. And then the outcome of the people who eat the oats, I don't know whether they would grow or be killed, the crops would be killed, but they were feather dusted with cereal rust spores and flown by M16A1 adapters, and they use these bombers for whatever technical purposes. I use those numbers because in the military and in the news media, they use aircraft with these numbers as if that number means anything. The article simply tells you what happened but doesn't explain any outrage, except that oats and food can be contaminated and were contaminated, and it was very successful to affect the seedling oats. Now I want to talk about the San Francisco siege. After I spent 8 years cross-filing the Warren Commission hearings, those 26 volumes of the witness testimony and evidence, after John Kennedy was killed, I knew that I had an education equal to any university in law or in criminology to solve these crimes, because the blueprint for assassinations, the blueprint for police involvement, for the legal involvement is all there. The use of doubles, of aliases, the tactical support. The work was not wasted in terms of general experience. When I was working to solve the John Kennedy assassination, I also was learning about the entire intelligence community and their modus operandi. My main files of newspaper clippings that I kept and try to keep in chronological order, outside of the filing cabinets and the boxes and drawers that I have, are in six main categories, and these are terribly important. One was the John Kennedy assassination, putting the articles in chronological order in three-hole notebooks so you could see how the story broke and ran through the years. That was in 1963. The Martin Luther King assassination in 1968. The Robert Kennedy assassination, 1968. These are all spiral notebooks that I have, and those of you who've seen my home know the research, the way they're lined up. And then the Manson family in 1969, followed by notebooks on the Chappaquiddick affair in 1969, the same year, and then the George Wallace shooting in 1972. Of course, there was too much Watergate to put in notebooks, but the reason I mention this is that in between these election violences where John Kennedy was killed, the President of the United States, it affected the 1964-68 elections. The Martin Luther King assassination that brought on Spiro Agnew and the riots just prior to the elections, Robert Kennedy's assassination altering the 68-72 candidate. Fitting in there was the German Nazi Reichstag military intelligence type of operation, the Manson family terrorism, that would affect political speeches, candidates, and the climate of America and begin this spread of terror into the suburbs, followed again by Chappaquiddick in 69, which stopped Ted Kennedy from running, and then Wallace shooting, which kept George Wallace from running, and those votes went to Richard Nixon. But many people don't understand the Manson role, the way the creation of the Manson family came right into this story. But one of the first articles, actually the first published article about Charles Manson, was in a magazine by Ed Butler called Did Hate Kill Tate? And it's about how the Black Panthers came into the white suburbs and killed these six white people because of their vengeance against society, and Death to the Pigs was written with blood over the door of the house. And it was written by Ed Butler, the man for military intelligence that worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and made a record with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans. And I began to immediately get connections of the links to the Kennedy assassination, to the Manson family. And that's how I got so early into studying the terrorism, by saving every article and breaking down the cast of characters and meeting policemen involved in the arrest and following that closely. And that's why I could get into the SLA story very early and the Jonestown. And because the San Francisco episode this weekend was so short, it's easier and not as complicated as Jonestown to study. I want to share it with you. First of all, the siege. The sniper went to a tall building in San Francisco. He had hand grenades tied to his body, a grenade belt. He had military commando clothing. And he went into a fairly straight, really straight building, not in the hippie part of town, the Unemployment Compensation Department building on 9th and Market Street. And at 5:29, he began to announce that he had this hostage. It wasn't difficult for him to get through the doors with that kind of an outfit and an orange backpack and all the weapons, his M1 rifle and so forth. He carried a lot of equipment and went right through this building upstairs. The only good thing about the whole weekend was that it got the Pope off the front page. The papers up here were just filled with it. I don't know how much coverage you got in the East Coast or up north or the Midwest, but immediately he was on the telephone calling the Chronicle newspapers. I've got a bomb here. Give me the mayor. I want a direct line with the mayor. And, of course, Dianne Feinstein and the others, Joe Freitas, the district attorney. There's a big San Francisco election in 4 weeks, a re-election, and their name was pretty muddy after the Dan White case and the Jonestown story that linked to all of them, and they're up for re-election, and the police department was looking pretty bad. There's a lot of crime there. There were riots during the gay demonstrations and the police harassing the gays. So the mayor became an instant a heroine, 17 hours on telephone calls. He asked for the mayor, and he wanted to speak to former President Ford. Somehow or other, it wasn't in our local newspapers. I didn't see that President Ford was in San Francisco, but in some way he began with asking to speak to Gerald Ford, who was up there, and we'll go to that in a little bit. He took a hostage, and she wasn't hurt. She was a secretary up in the building, Chio Tashimaro, and he kept her with him during this siege. Now, when Charles Bates was with the FBI and moved to San Francisco, he had been in Washington in the Justice Department investigating the Watergate, and then he was sent out here for the SLA operation and the zebra killings that preceded the SLA. Charles Bates was in Chicago in the FBI when Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were gunned down. When he resigned from the FBI just this last year, he took on a role with KGO radio station, which is a 24-hour propaganda bullshit station that has a lot of trivia, rock trivia, little interest stories, suggestions of where to eat and where to go in San Francisco. And if anything controversial gets on, they literally freak out. You can't make political connections, and they laud all the wrong people and interview them and praise them. The various people on the radio. Charles Bates went to work for KGO, which was a clue. and I might have mentioned a long time ago on these tapes, but I mentioned it on the air up there, that at KPFA, that with Bates in the area, the violence would continue because that was his expertise. And being at KGO, he'd be carrying the big stories. Now, strangely enough, he was totally silent this whole weekend. This is his expertise, and this gentleman said he was from the SLA. He called himself the SLA, woo, the World Organization, you know, for helping the poor. But Bates was peculiarly silent the entire 48 hours, which is not typical for Charles Bates. The police had a training school set up in San Francisco 4 years ago, in 1974. It was set up by a gentleman named Harvey Schlossberg, S-C-H-L-O-S-S-B-E-R-G. I wonder if he's from Project Paperclip. He began his work in Munich in 1972, working on terrorists at the Munich Olympic Games, and that's where 15 athletes and Arabs were killed on an army base. All 15 were blown up at an army base. And that was the beginning of TV violence with CBS and NBC right there at the Munich Olympic Games. The Jewish students were killed, but that's when the Americans got into the act and decided, well, we'll study terrorism. And Dr. Schlossberg was also, in addition to being a psychologist, he worked as a detective in New York, and he came to San Francisco in 1974. And that's when Charles Gaines from the Oakland COINTEL program, police activities there, he was moved to San Francisco. Bates was out from Chicago and Washington and London previously, and Dr. Schlossberg became the training center for terrorism, and he had schools for training police as far as San Diego, Eureka, California. He worked with the FBI, Naval Investigation Service, Nevada State Prison, Arizona State Police, and more than 70 agents. There were two police officers working with this hostage that got the main headlines. One was Vince Repetto. One newspaper article said that he was brought from Northern California, that he wasn't on the regular team. Another article said he was part of the San Francisco police team. But he had 4 years of training or 5 years of training with hostage work, but this was the second time in 5 years that he got to use the training. Of course, the headlines say police training pays off. They'd all been working 5 years, but Repetto was the gentleman, along with a female who had just finished her course. This was her first work at hostage work, and it was her dry run, and I think it was her graduation exercise, too. I don't know whether Repetto was brought in from the north or from San Francisco, but he worked with this particular riot training team. Now, the woman who was also brought in, Maureen D'Amico, 28 years old, some of the newspaper articles said that when they found out that the sniper liked women, a major breakthrough came Saturday morning when they discovered that he had a mother complex and that he was devoted to his mother, so they decided to bring women to help in the negotiations. But another article says a woman was the key negotiator, sniper, and she worked with Dr. Chris Hatcher, a psychologist from the University of California, Langley Porter, which was named as a recipient of CIA funds and experiments like Vacaville in California. And this story says that she was on the scene right from the start working with her co-negotiator, Officer Repetto, so that they were in charge of the entire negotiations. Now, the TV story on Sunday evening had an interview with a man who saw Cullinane when he broke into the building and said that he described him as a man who was dressed like a news media terrorist. If any of you saw the movie Putney Swope, you know what he's referring to. If you haven't seen it, go see it if it's on reruns or on television. Make a note and see the movie Putney Swope, and you'll see a TV terrorist. And that's the way he was dressed, and that's what he was. And all of these terrorists asked for the maximum attention by the news media and call the Examiner and the Chronicle and radio and television stations to get maximum attention. Now, Gerald Ford was in town. As I say, it wasn't in the papers that I noticed, the Examiner or the Chronicle or the San Jose Mercury, but this gentleman knew that he was in town, and an article said he was in San Francisco for a political appearance. Right away, the terrorism was associated in the news media with the politics and the elections, which it will be used by the politicians, you know, for the next weeks in San Francisco and the national elections, also Reagan and others. He's like Richard Nixon setting up his violence in Caracas, Venezuela. When Gerald Ford was in San Francisco running for president, Sarah Jane Moore took a shot at him, missed him, but was in San Francisco working with the FBI, got her weapons from the IRS, and went to their special gunmen over in the Bay Area. Squeaky Fromm in San Francisco from the Manson family was late. She was in Sacramento and took a pot shot, supposedly, at Ford, never explaining how in the world she got that close to him, and she's serving her time in prison for that now. If the media thought that he looked like a media terrorist, if the witnesses saw that, I also wonder about the woman, the hostage who was taken, the secretary that was taken for several days, Chio Tashiro. As soon as she was released and saw Mayor Dianne Feinstein, the first question she asked was, "Did I do okay?" And the response was super, super. The front page of the Sunday Examiner said, "Sniper's wild siege ends. The hostage is okay." Then next to it, right along with it, is "Bizarre Tale of New Manson Family." And of course, this is a story that comes out of Long Beach Independent Press, that the Manson family's on a spree again. You see, it's right side by side by the terrorists, that the Manson family has 60 members now, and the SLA has 100, and that they're now joined. And this particular terrorist in San Francisco was using the name SLA, that he was a member of the SLA. This article on the Manson family said that the street sources have told the FBI and other agents that they're planning something that will make the Patty Hearst thing look like penny ante. And I believe this could happen, but the authorities, if they have information on these people, are sitting by and watching it. They have said that the group has $2 million, that they have proficient helicopter pilots, they have stockpiled weapons, they have stockpiled gold, they have thousands of dollars of dry food, they've bought solar panels from New Jersey, scientific labs. Well, where are the weapons, and where's the food stockpiled, and who is the lab in New Jersey that has sent them solar panels? And the FBI, according to the Long Beach story, says has delayed arrest, that there was an August 26 burglary in the San Joaquin area of $20,000, another bank robbery in Sunnyvale, $199,000 armored car bank robbery in Stockton, and nobody is moving in on these robberies. Now, this is the way Nazi money and rightist organizations are funding money in England, fighting the Irish, and also in France and in Italy, by these bank robberies that admittedly have gone to right-wing Nazi groups. I talked last week about missing money from the Vatican and the dangers of not accounting for it. Well, this group, and these are neo-Nazis, the SLA Manson group, are not liberal in the sense that they want to feed the poor. It's the way that Adolf Hitler attacked the Wall Street gang and wanted to feed the poor. Joseph Romero from the SLA was quoted when he returned from Vietnam that he enlisted a second time because he didn't get enough action the first time. He came home then and murdered Dr. Marcus Foster, a black school head schoolmaster, head of the Oakland School District, the superintendent. The two ringleaders of the Manson family right now are supposed to be Kenneth Como and Catherine Gypsy Scher. I've talked to Gypsy. She's called me. I haven't talked to her in about a year. She's called me quite a few times. I've gotten letters from former prisoners. The FBI, CIA are allowing the Manson family outside of Folsom to form, and down in the Southern California area, it's a right-wing group that would link with the Minutemen and the San Diego Army, the secret army organizations that have intelligence connections. And I have talked to various people in prison and had contact with them through the years, and the prison system has indeed allowed them to get out and to begin to stockpile these weapons. According to this one article on Manson, they mentioned that he had a $600 guitar in prison, and that Kenneth Como now is wearing a $2,400 Tiffany gold watch and chain at Folsom. He must be the most heavily dressed dude at Folsom Prison. But there's a lot of money behind this group, and Charles Tex Watson, who did all the killings of the Manson family, and Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca, the next night, who did the stabbings and went into the homes, Manson wasn't in the homes, said that he would be getting out of prison, that there was organized crime money that would help him get out. He's now a pastor in San Luis Obispo and recently married. Now, the lingo in San Francisco, the newspapers and the radio, we got constant repetition of the words terrorism. This man was called Chief Cherokee of the SLA WOO. They referred to his comrades all the time, the compatriots, the hostages. And then there were other words. His first description was a Latin man, and the suggestion that maybe this is like El Salvador, Nicaragua, we should get ready. The girlfriend's name was Injun Tomlinson, and Chief Cherokee, the head of the Cherokee Nation. There were words like negotiating teams in the newspaper and on the air. Intelligence sources tell us he's friendly towards women. There's hostage negotiating training. There's police command centers. There's 12-member negotiating teams set up. There's sniper negotiators. These words were going through the radio and in the newspaper, and it's a whole new vocabulary that you'll get used to eventually. I bought a book recently, a wonderful book called The Doomsday Dictionary, and it's about our 20th century. It came out in 1963. Words like ABC, atomic, biological, chemical warfare, air, a definition of the difference between clean air and the kind of air that gets polluted, Konrad Adenauer, air raids, air bursts, the Alliance for Progress, anabiosis, that's suspended animation when the astronauts need food, water, and atmosphere, alpha, one of the three principal types of nuclear emissions, the apathy, how the Doomsday Dictionary comes into effect, what apathy is, asteroid bombs, and so forth. I will do maybe a tape for you if you can't get that book, The Doomsday Dictionary. But the Dictionary of Terrorism is also important because they implant the suggestion of all these commands and comrades when it turns out that with a well-trained team and one man and a very quiet hostage. Always in these stories are the aliases. This fellow was known as Chico Cochran to his girlfriend. He was Gary McIntosh with American Express cards. He was Gary Cullinan. He was Wayne Tilleman. He was Wayne Callahan. That turned out to be his real name. And he was William Chuck Cochran. And he was John Orchaco when he checked into a motel in Redwood City. Always there's multiple personalities, which reminds me of Candy Jones and Arlene Grant, and the creation of doubles for various purposes with different identifications and driver's license and so forth. While the police didn't have his name and didn't know who he was, they knew to put on women negotiators because they said he called his mother in Providence, Rhode Island, and he had called his girlfriend over in Berkeley, and they knew that he called his mother every week. At that time, they didn't know who he was, and they didn't know his real name, but they knew that he had contact with his parents, with his mother. And in this case, this girlfriend in Berkeley, and I'll go into a little further, reminds me that there were so many women involved in these other mind control programs where the women led the men and then faded away, knew a little bit and housed them or took care of them, but then faded out of the picture. But they seem to know that he was familiar with a lot of men, and so far there isn't one male that he's associated with that they've identified. There's also, again, the question of doubles, the suspicion of doubles. I don't know when or how they would come be switched, but the first man seen in the building was this 29-year-old Latin male, and he dark-complected, and he had been this person who later was arrested, had been in Tijuana, Mexico, and he was teaching children to box down there. The one who was arrested was from Rhode Island, a Catholic family, white, Irish, not dark-complected, and 22 years old. Not only were there discrepancies in what they saw and that person described, but the photographs in the newspaper, side by side, it appears to be a totally different person. There's a difference in the eyes, and there's a difference in the distance of the nose, the lips. There's a difference in the lip shapes. And also the mustaches are entirely two different people. No matter what he did when he was arrested and was photographed, picked up, you couldn't have two different mustaches and be shaved and have appearance when at the time you're apprehended and the time you're in the jail, there's a difference in appearance. On the other side of this tape, I want to go into his profile, the same mysteries that appear in all these assassinations and snipings and the same unanswered questions and some of the evidence that there's foul play here for creating this scene in San Francisco at this time.